You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. And now, here's today's message.
This is our 10th lesson in our series on parenting. And so we had four lessons on the foundations of parenting. We talked about the mission of parenting, shepherding a child's heart, the shaping of children, so the influences that bear upon them and the orientation of their heart and how they respond to those influences, the authority of parents, the nature of that authority and the exercise of that authority. And we talked about parenting goals. So that was the foundation. And then we had four lessons on particular methods for parenting. We talked about we need to get rid of unbiblical methods. And we sort of launched into the topic of communication. And then we talked about communication, picking the right tool for the job. And we can't just give our children rules. We need to use all the tools in the communication tool belt. And then we talked about a life of communication. We need to count the cost of engaging in communication with our children. It's going to cost us some things, but it's also going to bring a lot of blessings. Then in lesson 7, we talked about correction. So we talked about communication and correction. And then we talked about equipping and about we need to not only raise well-behaved children. The goal isn't well-behaved children. The goal is well-equipped adults. And we need to keep that in mind because sometimes we can have children that are so broken in and so well-behaved and so trouble-free that they are completely ineffectual adults. That's not the goal. If you want to have adults who are dangerous to the devil, then you're going to have children who are sometimes frustrating for you. It comes with the territory. And so we talked about some of that. We don't want to raise, manage tolerable children, but to equip adults for excellence in character and piety and life skills, discernment, education, stamina, and taste. So that was the second section. We talked about methods for parenting. And the final section of the course is dealing with the seasons of parenting, which is taking these foundations and these methods and weaving them together for the different stages of childhood. So we talked about infancy through about 5 years old last week. And then tonight we're going to talk about, and so during that season, the training goal, the fundamental training goal is authority. Our children need to know the reality of authority and the reality that they are not that authority. There is hierarchy in the world, and they are not at the top of the heap. God is, and there are many other agents of God between God and themselves. They are not the center of the universe. They are an individual who is under authority, and they can appeal to the authorities that are over them. That's the second lesson. And, of course, one of the primary training procedures for this stage of infancy to around 4 or 5 years old is the use of the rod to not to break their spirit, but to bring their will under control. I love that language that is used of meeking a horse. You don't want to crush the horse's spirit, but you want the horse's will to submit to yours, because otherwise it's not very useful. And that same principle is true of our children. So that's the first stage. And now we come to the second stage, which is childhood, typically from around 5 to 12. So from the end of infancy, the beginning of the school years, to the time when they would probably hit puberty or enter the teenage year. So that season of childhood. And then, Lord willing, the next time, so in a couple weeks when we deal with this topic, we'll finish up by talking about the launching season, the teenage years. And then we might have a final summary lesson. I haven't quite decided about that, but we have at least one more lesson in the series. So tonight we're talking about childhood. And one of the key characteristics of this season is that our children learn to do things apart from us. When they enter the season of childhood, we are doing everything for them. If you have a 4-year-old, you can't let them out of the house. You've got to you know, make sure that they, you know, you pick out their clothes. You're doing everything for them. You're feeding them. Maybe they can eat for themselves, but you're getting the food on their plate and making sure it's not too big. And you're doing almost everything for them. But by the time they're 12, you know, a 12-year-old who's been well-trained ought to be able to prepare a meal and to keep their room clean and to do chores and to do all kinds of things and to do it all without a huge amount of supervision. Now, still, you're, you know, checking up on them, right? You're not trusting them to do everything by themselves, but they're able to take on responsibility for themselves by the time they hit the teenage years. They ought to be. And if they've been trained to take on responsibility for themselves, then the teenage years are going to go a whole lot better than if they've never had any responsibility at all. They still need our supervision, and they're still under our control in a lot of ways, but they have a much greater need of wisdom because you aren't always there with them to remind them that the stove is hot. So you don't let an 18-month-old around a hot stove by herself. She does not have the wisdom to know, I've touched a hot stove before. This is not going to go well. You have to be there to say, hot, don't touch. And if she understands the principle of authority, then she won't touch what you told her is hot. But a toddler doesn't have the wisdom to test that something is hot before touching it. They ought to have the respect for your authority that if you tell them it's hot, they don't touch it. But they can't go from, this thing was hot and my parents told me not to touch it, so therefore this other thing, I'm going to check that it's hot before I touch it because it's the same sort of thing that I was told not to touch before. Right? A toddler doesn't think that way. And a child doesn't naturally think that way. And it's your job to get them to think that way, to think through the consequences of their actions. They need to learn wisdom. So infants need authority. Children still need authority. But to wisdom needs to be added. Wisdom. As Tripp puts it, the big issue during these middle years is character. Your child's character must be developed in several areas. You want your child to learn dependability, honesty, kindness, consideration, helpfulness, diligence, loyalty, humility, self-control, moral purity, and a host of other character qualities. You can't be with him or her all the time. He must know what to do in situations that you cannot anticipate. He needs biblical wisdom. And of course, I'm saying he because that's how he phrases it, but this applies to girls just as much as it does to boys. His conscience must develop as the reasoning factor of the soul so that he'll know what to do even when you're not there to tell him what to do. To say, this is like that, therefore don't do this, right? That's what you do with toddlers. But children need to learn to think through things and have an inner character in their own right. In your own words, before we dig into this, how would you articulate the difference between these two stages of parenting? So many of you have had children at these different stages. What would be some ways that you would articulate the difference between these two stages, between infancy to around 5 years old or 4 or 5 years old, and then the school years, basically, until they hit the teen years? Anyone want to take a stab at the difference between the two? Well, we'll have lots of other questions. Okay. The first thing we need to realize is that compliance does not equal character. As children grow, the tendency is to make the rules grow along with them, to add rules to deal with each unforeseen circumstance. So we leave them in a new environment, and we try to think of what are all the crazy things you can do. Don't swing from the chandeliers. Don't slide down the banister. Don't stay up all night. Don't steal anything. Don't eat all the cupcakes. We just try to think of all the rules, you know. We leave our 8-year-old at a birthday party for the first time, and we're like, what are all the things you might do? And we end up giving them a lot of bad ideas they wouldn't have had on their own, it may be. But they have all of these things, and we try to just add rules upon rules upon rules. But the problem, as Tripp puts it, with this approach is that it's impossible to make rules comprehensive enough to anticipate every need for direction. In addition, the adult mind is not clever enough to make rules that the child's mind cannot circumvent. And everyone who has a child in this age says amen. This is indeed the case. More rules won't work. You can use rules to teach obedience and authority, but obedience and authority are not enough to navigate through life. You can't use rules to instill character, and character is what children need to grow in. If you use rules to produce a simulacrum of character, you simply produce a Pharisee, a hollow shell that has about as much weight as a holograph. So you're trying to simulate character by saying, what would a person with character do at a birthday party? So I'm going to give you all these rules. Don't eat all the cupcakes. Well, you can give that rule, but what if there's cake and not cupcakes? You thought there was going to be cupcakes, but you didn't give a rule about pie or cake or ice cream or hot dogs. And so you get a report about your child. They only had one cupcake, but they ate four hot dogs. What's the matter with them? Well, you tried to use rules as a substitute for character, because what's the character trait they need to not eat all the food at the birthday party? Anybody, what's a character trait that would manage that one? Self-control and selfishness, right? Self-control, not just gorging on it. They would need that even if there was an unlimited amount, but also selfishness, which would think, hey, there's a limited supply of this. There is enough for everyone to get this amount. If I take this amount, someone else is going to go without. And so they need to know self-control. They need to know not to be selfish, but instead to be concerned about others, right? So these are character traits that they need. They need to have these instilled in them so that they can think through. It doesn't matter what the food happens to be at the party. Or maybe it's not food. Maybe it's some other treat or some activity that they don't hog it all to themselves, but instead they share. So this is where the rubber meets the road. Are we really going to deal with the heart issues? The reason that we emphasize authority in the little years is so that we have the respect to instill character in the middle years. Are we satisfied with well-behaved children while they're under our oversight? Or are we willing to do the work to raise up well-equipped adults? This is the challenge of these years. But before we can talk about how to instill character, we need to think about how we assess the character that is there. Assessing obedience is easy. Did they obey right away, without backtalk, and with a happy heart? Well, then they obeyed, right? You could say, did they obey, did they not obey? Check the box, A or B, yes or no. They obeyed or didn't obey. But character can't be assessed on a black and white, yes or no binary scale. Character, for us as adults, as well as for our children, is always a work in progress. And also, character is much easier to disguise. So our children are apt to pretend to have a character they don't have when they're around us because they don't want their character corrected any more than we do. When we're around someone who has the possibility of correcting us, we stand up a little bit straighter, we watch our words a little bit more carefully, but then when we let our hair down, our real character comes out. And the same principle is true of our children, and so we need to be asking good questions. As Wilson reminds us, our goal in these years is to train our children not to sit on them. And that's the tendency that parents have. It's a tendency that all of us have, that as our children are little, we have a few rules for them. But then as they grow older, we become more and more frantic. I'm not saying that all of you do or that I am, but this is the temptation that we have to impose rules and to try to think through everything and to be more and more controlling, when in fact, the opposite should be the case. The older our children are, especially as they enter into the teen years, the fewer rules they should have. Because the day is going to come when they walk out of your home and they are subject to exactly none of your rules. So if the only way they know how to live is by following your rules, they are completely unprepared for life. So as you are preparing them for life, your job is to instill character and remove rules. If the concrete's still totally wet, by the time they leave your home, the shape of the concrete is going to be determined by the world because the form is going to be gone and you'll have wet concrete sloshing all over the place with everybody's footprint on it, and your work will have been essentially wasted. We need to get the concrete set while there's time for the forms to do their work, and take the forms away and lay the next layer, and take the forms away and lay the next layer. That is our job during this season. If you go into the teen years still depending on rules entirely, they're going to be a disaster. But if you go into the teen years having seen some genuine character instilled and seen some progress, it'll always be a work in progress, in addressing issues of the heart, then the teen years can truly be a joy. So what is the danger of confusing compliance with character? What's the danger of confusing compliance with character? My last question didn't get any takers. Let's see, is there anyone who wants to take this one? Rick.
Pharisaism, legalism.
Is that a hand, Andrew? No. Okay. Anyone else? Tawny.
Actually know their heart.
Yeah, you don't actually know their heart. So as long as you have a strict amount of rule for how many cupcakes they can have, and you're dependent on that rule, you actually don't know how many cupcakes they would take without a rule. And so sometimes you have to let them fail, so that then you can address, okay, why did you do this? You're not like getting a spanking, right? This wasn't a disobedience issue, but this reveals something about your heart that we need to explore a little bit more, and give them opportunities to reveal what's in their heart so you can address it. If you have a rule for everything, then they'll never have a chance to express what's in their heart, and you'll never have a chance to shepherd that and say, hey, are you thinking about that? Sean, got a mic going for you, and then Brother Nate.
You've distorted the gospel, because in the Old Testament we have the law and we're under the law, and in the New Testament it's character and you are no longer under the law, but it's not that you are now free to just do anything you want, but in Galatians you're free to glorify God. And so if you are just living by compliance, you're putting them under the law and ignoring the gospel.
Yeah, exactly. And it can actually make it hard for them to see their need for a Savior. If you ever rule for everything and they can keep your rules, then they can't see the evil of their own heart. And if they can't see the evil of their own heart, they're going to have a hard time seeing their need for a Savior. And so we have to move on from just compliance to character. That was really helpful, Sean. Nate?
Kind of along the same lines, not only do you not know their heart, but they don't have a chance to navigate these things, and they don't know their own heart.
It may be that they're shocked with what comes out of their own heart, and that is what motivates them to actually, maybe they're just sort of going along, and you've been pointing this out, and you've been pointing this out, and you've been pointing this out, and they're kind of like, they don't get it. But then as they have a situation they don't have rules for, they're shocked by how they respond, and they actually want to listen because they're like, I don't like this sort of person that I am. I want to change. Will you help me? And that really changes the picture. Sean.
I think it also like stunts their ability to exercise wisdom, because wisdom is where they're like, if they're constantly obeying rules and then there are no rules, then and they're still trying to do what is right, but they've never had an opportunity to choose between options, then they'll get, be lost without any previous practice.
Yeah. And I think this is like sometimes what parents try to do with very young children by asking them what they want to eat and they're training them to make decisions. But actually, first they need to learn about authority, then they need to learn about character. And you don't learn about the wisdom you need for character by choosing what you wear. That's not actually training them for the sort of decision-making that they need to make in life. Because, it's your character when you want to do something and you have to decide, should I do this? Not, I get to pick what I eat for breakfast. That's actually not the kind of decision-making they need, training in. But it's rather those situations where they need actual wisdom, not preferences. And that's what we're trying to instill in these years. Was there anyone else? Thought I saw one more hand up. Another question here. Did I miss someone? No? Okay. Have you ever felt if I'd been there, I could have controlled my child, but I wasn't there? And subsequently, they were not controlled. Does anyone feel brave enough to share a particular situation on that one? I have definitely felt that way, but I'm not remembering the details. Perhaps too conveniently. Janine.
So, you're welcome, Donna. So, this is Donna's story. We went to visitation, myself and Sherry Berger, and while we were gone, the kids were with Grandma, and that one right there, and Donna went to the restroom because she was potty training and she was done and she knew how to do all of that, but Sarah was just learning. So Grandma put Sarah on the toilet, told Donna to stay there and keep her company, and then she had to go run and do a few things because she's the secretary of the church at the time. And she went and did a few things and then realized all of a sudden that it was really quiet in there, and they had paper mache'd the downstairs bathroom with toilet water and the toilet paper. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a situation that if I was there, that wouldn't have happened. If Grandma had stayed in there, that wouldn't have happened. So many oversight thingies just kind of missed on that. But yes, I think that's kind of what you're looking
for. Yeah,
right?
That revealed something. That revealed an inner artistic desire that was in her heart or something. I'm not sure exactly, but you know. Unfortunately, not all of the things that come out of our children's hearts are quite as innocent and fixable as paper mache with toilet water. Sometimes it's other people that are harmed and not just our time and temper. Anyone else on that one? That was a good story, Janine. I'll have to remember that for her wedding whenever she gets married. Jan.
When our kids were growing up, they would want to do things, and my husband would tell them what he thought they should do, but he would give them the chance to make the decision themselves. Mm. He would give them all the biblical reasons why they should or should not do it. But one time we had my nephew there who had not been raised by us, and when my husband tried to do the same thing for him, it kind of backfired because he had not been raised that way to start using and making his own decisions.
Yeah, and that's something that we can't start out with high consequence decisions. We've got to start out with low consequence decisions, and through these years, we're upping the ante and we're helping to instill character. So what we need to be doing is, compliance and character are not the same thing, and so we need a way not simply to assess whether they're obedient or not, but to actually assess their character. In order to assess their character, we need to ask some good questions, and Tripp presents a diagnostic tool for assessing character, and his diagnostic tool consists of asking questions about the child in relationship to God, the child in relationship to himself, and the child in relationship to others. So we need to ask, and he suggests that we periodically take some time to evaluate our children, maybe once a year, maybe twice a year, and really talk, perhaps with our spouse, and really talk and think about how are they actually doing? Where are they actually at? Where are their weak points? Where are their strong points? What can we use to, where are some good starting points where we could work from maybe something they're strong in to help strengthen something that they're weak in? How are we doing in terms of developing their character? So when we think about their relationship to God, the primary question that we need to be asking is not, have they made a profession of faith and did they really mean it? And children growing up in a Christian home will often make many such professions of faith, and despite our best efforts, experience shows that it's all but impossible to determine which of them is genuine. In any case, teaching them to constantly worry about the sincerity of their prayer and to look back to their prayer teaches them to focus on themselves instead of focusing on God, and in the long run, it actually undercuts the gospel we're trying to ground them in. And so when we're talking to our children about faith, we should always be pointing them not to, well, did you do this? Did you really mean it? We should be pointing them to faith in Jesus is what saves, and the Holy Spirit is the one who gives faith. Everyone who believes in Jesus will be saved. Point them to Jesus, not to themselves. Point them to Jesus over and over and over again, because Jesus is the one who can save. It is Spirit-given faith in Christ that saves, not the sincerity with which we prayed the sinner's prayer or the vividness of our memory of that one time that we think we really meant it. And so that's not what we should be focusing on when it comes to assessing our children's character in reference to God. If that's not what we should be focusing on, then what should we be focusing on? And the question about the nature of his relationship question is, what is the nature of his or her relationship with God actually like? So the question isn't about what they say they agree with, because young children are going to agree with what you say if you phrase it right. The question is, how are they actually living their lives? So these are some of the questions we should be asking about our children and seeking an honest answer to. Do they show a conscious need for God independently of us? Are they moved by spiritual truths, especially truths that don't benefit them directly? Right? If a spiritual truth is, well, this is a good thing for you, so you can have comfort, or you can have this, or you can have that, well, that could be falsely motivated. But if they're motivated and they are moved by God's power and God's beauty and God's holiness in ways that aren't like directly benefiting them, those are questions we should be asking about what their relationship with God really is like. Do you have to remind them to read the Bible and pray, to sing in church? Or are these things they're motivated to do on their own? So we sing beautiful songs that are full of spiritual truth. Are your children moved by them? Are they singing, or do you have to be, get your hymn book out, sing the songs, come on, we're in church? Those are questions. Are they moved by the reality of spiritual things? Are there false gods that they're bowing down to? This isn't just about what's their relationship with the one true God. We also need to be asking, what's their relationship to idols? What are the idols that are threatening to take over their heart and bump out the worship of the one true God? Material possessions. Do they live for the next thing that they can get? Popularity. Is their world controlled by whether this particular child likes them or says they're not their friend anymore? Thrill-seeking, control over you, over other children, over their schedule, over their circumstances. When things don't go their way, do they have a meltdown? It could be revealing an idol of control. It's not just adults that are tempted to worship idols. This is also the case for our children. So when we're assessing their relationship to God, we shouldn't just be asking positively, are they doing this thing that they should be doing? But are they worshiping idols they should not be worshiping? We need to be asking what their character, what their relationship to God really is like. What are some other idols that even children could be bowing down to that I didn't mention? Or more fleshing out some of the ones I did. Video games. Fun, like just having fun. Yeah. Video games could be an idol where they live for video games and they're more motivated by video games than by anything else. That could be a concern. They may say all the right words. Oh, I prayed the prayer. I did that. I'm good. And yet, if video games is what they love, video games is what they worship. And that could be a concern. Yeah, too, yeah. I was just, you jinx on that one, because that is not only 9-year-olds who live for video games, sadly enough. Brother Ron.
Noticing if they have a concern for others that they know that are hurting.
Mm.
Or people, maybe homeless people, just some of those things that they could run across if they initiate, like, praying for them and things like that.
Yeah.
Definitely show their heart.
Yeah, that can, I think one of the things really, like, listening to them pray and what they pray for, that's been something, like, are they praying for maybe the needs of others or praying something about God? Or is it just, God, give me, give me, give me, give me, give me, give me, give me? That reveals what they think about God, and it reveals their thoughts about God fall very far short of what the scripture reveals about God. And so that's something we, you know, it's not like every time a character flaw is revealed, we pounce on it. Don't you know you have the character of a reprobate? You need to change, right? That's not, you know, if people did that with us, we wouldn't change, right? But we're trying to steward their character over the long run. And so we're constantly observing and looking for those teachable moments where we can say, hey, this is something that I've noticed about your character for a while now, and this sort of is revealing it, and let's talk about this, because, you know, we're talking in this instance about the relationship with God. You say you're a Christian, but your love for God seems a bit lacking. And maybe you could think of some ways to encourage them to show more love for God. And if they really are, if they have come to true faith, then they're going to feel convicted. They're not going to make excuses. And that's really one of the ways, as children begin to be convicted, that we can start to see that God's really working in their heart. Anyone else? What are some other idols that they might bow down to? Keith? Got a mic coming to you.
I think as parents, we can have an idol of what you shouldn't do. And we have that lifted up in there above them instead of what they should do toward God.
Yeah.
And then the kids focus on what they shouldn't do instead of what they should do.
Yeah, they could have an idol of compliance that they want to be the good. So they could be the ones that want to have all the rules because they feel they can keep the rules and they don't want to deal with their actual character. And so they could have this idol of being a nice little rule keeper. So children can be Pharisees too. That's really helpful that you pointed that out. Sweetheart.
I would say an idol of activity and like social interaction, wanting to be with friends or just be doing something, kind of fills their days and life and heart.
Busyness is not an idol for adults alone, for sure. And so remember, in all of these things, when we're talking about the relationship to God, we're not asking what they know as test answers. We're asking how they actually live in relation to God. So we need to ask, what is our children? So what we're talking about is that our goal is to instill character into our children. If we're going to be working at instilling character into our children, then we need to be assessing what character they actually have. We need to be working at assessing their character. So the first area we need to assess is their relationship to God. But we also need to ask them questions about their relationship to themselves. So how does the child think about himself or think about herself? Is he self-aware or self-deceived? Some children seem to naturally have an inflated view of their own abilities. They're prone to pride. They think that because they read a book about something, they know how to do it. And they would be able, for example, hypothetically, to survive in the wilderness for weeks because one time they read a book about surviving in the wilderness. And they have this inflated view of their own ability. And that inflated view needs to be corrected. Other children feel like a failure, and they're prone to discouragement, and they're like, I could never ride a bicycle. I could never do that. And I don't even want to try because I know I can't do it. I could never do division. I mean, addition and subtraction were hard enough. I could never do this thing. It's too hard. I can't figure out what 4 divided by 2 is. It's too hard for me, right? Some children could be like that. They're prone to self-deprecation and self-doubt. And we talked about this earlier. We need to know what our children's character tendencies are, because if you're constantly trying to puncture the pride balloon of someone who's already deflated, it's not going to be very helpful. Or if you have someone who's completely full of themselves and you keep telling them how wonderful they are, you're not going to give them the help that they need. So if we're going to instill character in our children, they need a wide range of character strengths, then we need to assess where their character is actually at. So what's their view of themselves? All of us have natural bents. Some children, some people are naturally tender-hearted. And that's a good thing. But the flip side of that is that they can be prone to be manipulated or to abandon the truth due to sentiment. So they're tender-hearted and they're compassionate, but they can lack backbone. And they can compromise where they shouldn't. Other children are not that way. They are naturally stubborn. And they are prone to hurt others rather than to give an inch from their lofty position of infallible correctness on everything. Some children are naturally driven. Some children are not naturally driven, but are instead naturally lazy. And if we're not careful, we can mistake these natural bents for the genuine spirit-empowered character that we're seeking to develop. And so it could be you have a child that just is driven to do stuff. and you have another child who is not driven to do stuff, and you're like, why can't you be like your sibling who works so hard? But it could be they actually don't have the character trait of diligence. They just have the drive to be doing something. And they discover video games, and you discover that what you thought was diligence was just a desire for busyness. And diligence and a longing for busyness are not the same thing. But they may look the same way in an 8-year-old. Especially if your rules determine the available options of what they can do. The character trait of diligence is doing what needs to be done, not simply doing whatever you feel like doing for the sake of doing something. So we need to assess what are our children's natural bent so we can see, is this actually character that's being developed? Or is it just their own natural inclinations being so shaped by the rules and circumstances you've put in place that it seems to be having a good outcome for the time being? When we are assessing our children's character growth, we need to be honest and realistic about what our children have to work with. This is going to be a difference between adopted children versus biological children. Often when children are adopted, they're adopted out of difficult situations or even just the trauma of losing their parents. And so we need to be realistic with what they've been given to work with. Where are they starting from? For biological children, is biological children the children that come from our, come from your wife's womb and from, anyways, as your biological children come into this stage, often your own childhood weaknesses will begin to reappear in ways that feel much worse than you remember yourself being. Our memories can play tricks on us, by the way. And you need to have compassion because sometimes your own weaknesses can be the most infuriating ones. The weaknesses that you feel you've overcome can be really hard to see come up again in your children because you feel like you should have overcome it generationally. But the fact is, it doesn't work that way. And don't expect your children to overcome in 10 days something that took you 10 years to master. You should also be aware that this can put a strain in your marriage when that thing that your wife finds annoying about you, or you find difficult about your wife, that you've mostly figured out a way to work beyond, shows up in your children, and your children are there every single day. And they haven't learned to master that difficult character trait. And they dial it up to 11 every single day. So be prepared. This stage, as many of you know by the laughs that I'm getting, can be a strain. I need to work around that. As you're assessing, though, your children, you need to be realistic. You gave them, if they're your children, you gave them the genes that they have. And that means some of their weaknesses come from you. And remember, how long did it take you to overcome that? Maybe you can help them do it a little bit faster, but you're not going to be able to make the problem simply disappear. This same problem, and by the way, when it comes to your weaknesses with your children, you've got to learn to laugh at it rather than being offended about it. You've got to find ways. So this is another way that this can work. When when your children are exhibiting your weaknesses and then your spouse is really upset about those weaknesses, you could take that personally like it's actually an attack on you. But you need to be able to recognize that you actually had those weaknesses and hopefully you've done some work to overcome them, but learn to laugh at your weaknesses rather than being offended when you realize that you've passed them on to the next generation. And the same principle applies to strengths. You also need to be aware of what your strengths are and what your children's strengths are likely to be. So a child who is bright can sometimes fail to develop diligence and end up handicapped later on in life. So a child who naturally does really well at their school may never learn to actually work at something that doesn't come very easily to them. So you need to find ways to push them in that. So the child in relationship to himself, we need to actually ask and push into what is our children's character really like internally. Not just how are they making my life easy or difficult. Not just what other adults have I gotten in trouble with because of something my child did. But what is their character actually like? What kind of person are they developing into? Because if we're going to instill character, and then we need to begin by assessing character. What are some other questions that we could ask about our child's relationships to themselves? So their inner development, the sort of person that they are inside, apart from their relationship to God or to others. We'll talk about their relationship to others, but their relationship to themselves, the sort of inner character and bent that they have, what are some other questions that we could ask about that? Brother Nate.
I don't have a question, but just kind of a comment to add on to what you're saying. Something for the younger people that don't have kids to pay attention to is that when you have a child that receives some of these weaknesses from you biologically, you have that biological responsibility, but you also have, if you've done work like you're talking about to overcome it, you also have
a resource.
Yeah, you have a resource. Like, that work will reap dividends when you go to help your child to overcome those weaknesses. And so when you're younger, you don't have children, you can just think, you can use that to think forward on how important it is to be fighting these weaknesses and how useful it will be, not just for you, but for your possible children.
And there's actually, I don't want to get into the weeds too much about this, but there's some really interesting research that's been done about, so like your DNA can't be changed necessarily, but the way the DNA is methylized can actually be changed by the life choices that you make. So even not only with the mother, but also with the father. And they've done some really, it's all still very experimental at this stage, but they've done some really interesting studies based on even maternal nutrition, how that can have a significant effect on the children, but also the healthiness of the father, where you can have generational interventions where the choices you make as an adult before you give birth to children can actually have an effect on how your children turn out. So they'll inherit some of your weaknesses, but also we can make a difference. And exactly how this works is still very mysterious and not very well sorted out. But there's some really interesting research and work about how the decisions that we make can actually, like, we can actually improve the next generation in a way. I didn't have that on my notes, and I probably should have left it out. But there's some really interesting work. I did some reading on this at one point, and it was interesting. So let's talk about the child in relationship to others. How does the child relate to others? What's your relationship with your child like? Is it truly affectionate? So your child in relationship to others. First, in your relationship to you. Is it truly affectionate, or do they act like they'd rather be a part of a different family? Remember, as a parent, you can't be sidetracked by personal offense. Sometimes your children can be offensive to you. You have to be the adult. You have to serve as their parent. You have to keep the focus on the character issues of discontentment and grass is greener thinking. So when your children are like, I wish I was a part, or maybe they won't say this, but they act like they wish they were a part of a different household, the temptation is to be really focused on the personal insult that is to you. But you have to be the adult. And you have to look at what is this revealing about their character that maybe needs addressing. And how can I address it as a character issue in them and not a personal insult to me? How does your child relate to their siblings, especially their younger siblings? This can reveal a lot about the idols of their heart. So, do they take advantage of the younger siblings? Do they trick them into giving up their candy so that they can have more candy, for instance? Or are they genuinely concerned about their younger siblings? Are they selfish and uncaring? That's one kind of idolatry. On the other hand, are they possessive and controlling, trying to act like the parent? It's another form of idolatry when they are trying to be the boss because they have to be the boss of something, and they may be bowing down to the idol of control. So how they relate to their siblings, if they have siblings. How do they relate to other children? Are they bossy and controlling? Or on the other hand, are they clingy and dependent, where they just have to have the approval of other children in order to survive? How do they relate to other adults? Is their default attitude, you can't spank me, so you can't tell me anything? Well, that reveals something about their heart, that they have not yet internalized the principle of authority. They may be under your control, But they have not learned the fundamental principle of authority in the way that they should. How do they respond to their enemies when they're hurt? Do they plot revenge? What are some other questions you could ask about your child's relationship to others? Anyone? Child's relationship to others. Brittany.
I guess I would also, it's not necessarily asking the child, but asking those who know your child well. So whether it's godly grandparents, people in the church, just anybody else that you trust that they are discerning and that you can see that they have a genuine relationship with your child, like how, like especially if they go over to their house without you, how they act, like what they see in your child, what they see strengths or weaknesses, maybe how they act if they have their own children, how they act with non-siblings that are, you know, younger than them. So asking wisdom from other either other parents or just other people that know your child, that you trust, obviously. And also, when you brought up children wanting to be part of another family, it made me think of when Andrew was deployed and it was just me, and how Ian had expressed wanting just daddy and not wanting to be with me anymore. And that can, I guess, that take, not taking offense to that and realizing that there is hurt in the fact that Andrew isn't there and it's not necessarily expressed in the right way. And so having that, even if you're not a military family, but if daddy's gone for a long time or a parent's gone or maybe they're just sick and they're not available for a long time and the child's hurt or frustrated or disappointed by that, expressing that in maybe an offensive way with and helping them through that instead of, you know, just letting it, helping them through that frustration and being able to communicate it in a way that's correct but not insulting.
Yeah, I think that's really important that we not be insulted primarily, but try to think through how we can help them express that and maybe sort through. Maybe they're not even meaning to be insulting. But then I think the other point you made before that too, of really asking others. Like sometimes we can have blind spots and we can think our children are all that in a bag of chips. And the fact is sometimes they're not all that in a bag of chips. And sometimes we can have blind spots and we can be hesitant to listen to criticisms of our children because it can feel like a criticism of us. Because maybe our children are being weak in an area that we are still weak. And so we feel really insulted, but we need to listen because maybe we have some character we need to grow in. And maybe people can be insulting and rude too, but we need to actually listen and think, is there some truth to this about my children? Maybe because of my own weakness, I've been unwilling to address something because it would require repentance on my part. And that can be a big temptation too. Anyone else on that before we? Brother Bill. And then, sweetheart.
One of the things that we also need to know is when someone that has kids ask us, "Our, you know, how was my kids?" The worst thing that we can say is, "Oh, they were perfect angels." Because they're going to go, "Really? They're not that way at home." So we just need to be, if they're going to ask us, we need to be honest with them.
Yes, exactly. I think telling the truth.
Yes.
And this goes even to what I was talking about this morning. That we just need to be a community that is willing to tell the truth to one another. And then willing to deal with the consequences of telling the truth, to tell the truth in love, and then to do as long as it takes to really pursue real reconciliation. But if the children, if you watch the children and they're little hellions, don't lie to their parents. That's not helpful. You know, you don't have to give a blow-by-blow, you know, of every single thing they did that got on your nerves. That may not be helpful. But don't lie to them. You know, you can tell them the truth. Well, they did this, and they did this, and they did this. And maybe these are some concerns. Sweetheart.
To kind of check in with how our kids are doing relationally, I have questions that I save on my phone for times when I get with just one-on-one. And it's a lot of times focus around, like, who are your closest friends right now? How would they describe you as a friend? You know, and just, like, navigating, like, good questions with them about, like, why is that person your friend? Mm-hmm. And what would they say about you, and trying to teach them how to have good, deeper relationships.
Yeah. Or, like, what do you like? What makes you like that person? Like, what do you like about them? Those sorts of questions are really, really good. Those are really good things. Those are really good things to ask. So Tripp recommends taking... Was there someone else? Janine. Okay. One more on this, and then we better move on.
One last thing. Like, if a teacher comes to you, too, as a teacher, and says, okay, there's this thing happened tonight, or whatever like that, don't get offended at that either.
Right.
Because it might be one of those outliers that you might need to say something. I really appreciate, like, Hannah and Gil, because I've gone to them and I said, you know, I corrected your daughter about putting on her shoes. I've had talked to them about this. And she says, we've been working on that. And I said, this week she did so well. So don't forget to go back and praise, too.
That's really good.
If you noticed a good thing. Telling the parent, hey, you've done a good job. They did well this week. You know, things like that.
Yeah, if we only say something when it's an emergency, then that could be a problem. And I think one thing, building off of what you said too, that it's not just our children where they're at that we need to be paying attention to, but as we're trying to help one another, you may want to think, well, this parent, they've gotten a lot of criticism and some people have been really unkind to them, so I'm going to be looking for as many ways to encourage them as I possibly can. This parent is completely stuck on themselves and they think their children are all that. And so not that I'm going to be just like making anything up, obviously, but they need to realize that their children are not nearly as well behaved as they imagine them to be. And so maybe they need some opportunities to see that, right? So as you're looking at your brothers and sisters in Christ, it's not just their children who have strengths and weaknesses, it's the parents who have strengths and weaknesses, as you are. And you need to be thinking about where they're at, so that you give them the right medicine that actually helps them get to where they need to be, so that together we can move forward in being faithful to Jesus. So we need to take stock. We need to assess our children's character. And once we have assessed their character, and of course this is an ongoing process, then we need to address their hearts. So in the early years, we begin to address the heart, but the focus is on establishing authority. But a foundation doesn't do you much good to protect you from the storms of life if you don't build on that foundation. A bare foundation won't protect them from the storms if you build on it a house of hay. So we lay this foundation of authority so that we can build on that foundation, character, and addressing their heart. So the goal in these years is to get under the behavior to the heart motivations. It isn't enough to tell our children, hey, you have a character issue. Well, they don't know what a character issue is. We need to help them see what they need to grow in by appealing to their consciences. And stories are so important in this respect. When Jesus confronted the Pharisees who knew the rules but missed the point, Jesus told them stories over and over again. And we need to realize that not just our children, but we as adults, we as humans, are in many ways narratival creatures. And when it comes to instilling character, the stories that we tell them or the stories that we read to them are of fundamental importance. And when I say instilling character, I don't just mean the neat little moral stories that tell you what the moral is at the end of the story and are completely wooden and obviously intended just to bang you over the head with the point. Right, those aren't the kind of stories that are typically going to develop character in your children. They need stories about real characters. Not just real as in they actually existed, but real as in rounded characters who have weaknesses and strengths that you can use to have conversations about character traits so that they can see and understand what you're talking about. So, and you can draw on those stories in conversations for years to come. So we need to pay attention to the stories that they read and help them, guide them towards good stories. Oftentimes parents, and I talk about this a lot because it's something that we need to really get. Sometimes parents can just be Does it have any bad words? No. Does it have any sexuality that's too much for their age? No. Does it have any, like, you know, bad stuff in it? No. Okay, this is a great story for them. Often those are the worst kind of stories. If all you give them is marshmallow fluff, are they going to be very healthy? No. What you ought to be doing is looking at the nutrition label and saying, how much protein does this story have? Does it have some good carbohydrates? Is there some fiber? Okay, there's a seed or there's a bit of a nutshell or something. That's fine. Right? You don't want to be giving them poison, obviously. Like, there's some stuff that's just poison that no one should be reading. But what we really want to be doing is giving them some substance. We need to read to our children. We need to ask, what are the stories teaching them about how the world works? We should protect our children from lies about the world rather than lying to them in a futile attempt to protect them from the world. As Nate Wilson put it in an article about the scary stories that he writes for children, overwhelmingly, in my own family and far beyond, the stories that land with the greatest impact are those where darkness, loss, and danger, emotional or physical, is a reality. But the goal isn't to steer kids into stories of darkness and violence, because those are the stories that grip readers. The goal is to put the darkness in its place. Chesterton put it this way: fairy tales don't tell children that dragons exist. Children already know that dragons exist. Fairy tales tell children that dragons can be killed. Those are the kinds of stories that our children need to have. Not just the stories they read, but the stories they watch also shape them, sometimes even more than the stories they read. So what are the stories that they are watching teaching them about how the world works? As the Ricketts put it in their book on parenting, the question is not, are there bad people in this movie or in this book? Are there bad things that happen? Oh, can't go there. Well, you can't go here either, can you? Because there's a lot of bad things that happen in the Bible. Like pages falling out of it. The question is, how are the bad people portrayed? The most important question is, what is the moral compass by which this ship is being steered? This isn't just something we should ask for our children. This is something we should ask for ourselves, because we are more shapeable than we realize. So at one level, you absolutely need to simply ask, what are you putting before your eyes? We should never watch anything that borders on the pornographic, for example. We should never saturate our eyes with gratuitous violence, for example. So certainly there's some things we should not watch or listen to simply because of the content and how gratuitous it is. But at another and even more important level, we need to ask how we're training our hearts. So whether or not gay sex is presented on the screen, is the show pushing you to see sodomy and transgenderism as normal? Because a whole lot of shows that don't have any sex scenes have an agenda, and that agenda is to normalize homosexuality, and you are not immune to that agenda. So how's it shaping you? Can sex ever truly be consequence-free? If it's hookup relationship after hookup relationship, and it's not shown, it's not explicit content, but it's shaping you that it's normal to go to bed after the first date. Is that true? No, it's not. It's perverse. And if what is perverse is portrayed as what is normal, that will shape you. And certainly, it will shape your children. So, we need to pay attention to the stories our children are reading. And it's not just we're trying to protect them from what is bad. We're trying to equip them with the truth that the dragons can be killed. That's what we're trying to equip them with. Your character weaknesses don't have to define you. Don't you know the story about X in the Chronicles of Narnia? How he was a nasty little child, and he met Aslan, and he really did change, and he still struggled. And you can go over that story, and you can use that in conversations with your children, especially if you're reading something out loud to them, or if they're reading a book that you've read that shaped you, and you can have conversations about that. And you can bring it up, and it can help you. Stories in the Bible, obviously, we want to have them saturated with those stories, and you can help them, not just this abstract, don't you know, you need to be reliable. Well, you can tell them stories about the importance of reliability and dependability. And you could take them, for example, to the story of David, how the reason David had the confidence to take Goliath on was because he'd been faithful to defend his little sheep from a lion and a bear. And therefore, David wasn't trembling in his boots when it came to Goliath because he defeated the lion and the bear. There are stories that will help our children grow in their character. And that is one of the primary ways, through stories, that we can appeal to their consciences so that they actually understand the heart issue that they need to develop in. Can you give an example of appealing to the conscience? Something, either an example you've thought of or an example from practice. Elisha? And then Brittany.
Just a thought. What do you think about if you read a book to a kid and there's a rounded character with positives and negatives, ask the kid what was good about them and what do you think was a problem in their character? Do you think that would be an effective tool?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we can do that. We can ask, who did you like? You know, especially as when they're young, if you watch something, you can be like, who did you like? What did you like about them? You know, that could be something. Brittany?
So also telling stories about your own life and being
revealing.
Sure. So you're talking about David and Goliath, and that obviously we want to talk to them about David and Goliath, but that can seem very abstract in a way to a small child. But being able to tell stories of your own life, whether when you were a kid or just even more recently, or even how you sinned against them. Like, you remember when mommy said we could do this, and then you were disappointed because we didn't do this, and I had to apologize and say I'm sorry for saying we could do this. And going back on that, like, talking about that character trait of commitment and being dependable, remember when mommy wasn't dependable and how you were disappointed and how you felt? So that was another thing. And also another question can be like, who is the bravest character in this book? Or, and like, and pick a character trait that you're wanting to highlight when it's a, you know, a novel, like a chapter book that has some depth to it, and you can then pick that character trait and say who you know did this, the, you know, had this character trait, and or where did you see that in the story, and then be able to build off of that.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we've tried to do with the lending library and with even the bookstore as well, is try to find some good stories that are filled with good character traits that are actually going to be help start conversations like these. And so that's something I've been excited that we have even children lending stories back and forth in the church, things like the Wingfeather Saga or the Chronicles of Narnia or the S.D. Smith, the one with all the rabbits. Green Ember, the Green Ember series, those are really good books to have. And as our children read them, and you have children in different families who read them, then you can even have the children learning lessons and sharing those lessons with one another as well. Anyone else before we move on? All right. So, developing character. As Tripp defines it, a character could be defined as living consistently with who God is and who I am. So character, what we're trying to develop, could be defined as living consistently with who God is and who I am. So dependability. He gives two examples, moral purity and dependability. First, dependability. So first we start with truth, and then we go on to training. So the truth, and these truths come from Tripp's book. Who God is. He made me. He placed me here at this time. He is ultimate. I must stand before him one day. I must give account before him. He has promised to draw near to those who are humble and contrite in heart. He will help me to know his strength and aid. I can know him and the ability to obey him. He has promised blessing to those who are dependable. So that's the truth about who God is, drawn from the pages of Scripture as it relates to the development of dependability in our children's lives. There are also truths about who we are. I am a creature. I have been made by God for God. He has placed me here at this time and given me these opportunities. I must bring honor to him. I am made to bring him glory. As I draw near to him and seek his face, he will enable me to obey him and come to know his help and strength. God promises to give grace to all who call upon him. So these are truths about who God is and who we are, and character, good character, not being a character, like, you know, I have some characters in my family, not that kind of character, but the character we're trying to instill could be defined as living consistently with who God is and who I am. So as we're training our children to be dependable, our training must be rooted in these truths. The goal isn't simply for acceptable behavior to be memorized. Now, there are times for acceptable behavior to be memorized. If your children are socially awkward, as some children are and some adults are too, then it might be appropriate to say, I know you have the right character that you desire to be a blessing to others, but you have to learn that what comes naturally to you is not a blessing. So because you have this character right, then here's some training that's going to enable you to express that character. Certainly, there is a time for that. But character can't be reduced to war gaining and coming out with a solution, right? That may be how character manifests itself, but that in itself is not character. Character is when the foundational truth is internalized. And when we have the wisdom to live according to what the scriptures say about who God is and who we are and how the world works. That is how this wisdom, this character, will continue to operate even when we're not around to guide them in what they should do. So our goal isn't to give them a capable standard of dependability. Our goal is instead to reveal to them their need of God's grace in their everyday life. Because the truth is, in our own strength, our character falls short. We fall short of God's glory, and our children do too. So our children need to realize that they fall short, because that's what's going to reveal to them their need for a Savior and their need to have faith in Jesus. Tripp gives another example, that of moral purity. Once again, our training in the area of character of moral purity must be grounded in who God is and who we are. God made me, he owns me, he has created the boundaries for relationships, he has promised great blessing and protection for those who honor him in their relationships, and has warned of slavery and ruin which comes upon all those who fail to honor his desires. The relationships I enjoy for life is to be a picture of his relationship with the church. God gives what he commands, therefore he can be known in a way that gives self-control. That's who God is. Who I am. I am a creature. I am made by and for God, who is all-wise. I have needs that can only be fulfilled in the context ordained by God. I am called to a lifestyle of fidelity. I am responsible before God for the quality of the relationships that I have. As I honor God, I find completeness in him, and then completeness in the person God has for me. If I dishonor him or allow myself what he has forbidden, then I suffer irreparable loss of dignity, shame, and degradation. God doesn't judge on the curve because we live in a crooked and perverse generation. Your children are not called to have more moral purity than the kids down the street. Your children are called to be morally pure and to reflect the character of God. That's the character we're trying to instill in them. We must still strive to raise children who are morally pure, regardless of where our culture happens to be. And we aren't going to get that by avoiding the topic. You need to remember that porn is seeking out your children, your daughters, as well as your sons, at younger and younger ages. You cannot protect them from any exposure to evil sexual content. But what you can do is equip them to know how to respond to it before they're tempted to pursue it. So take the Bible as your cue. The book of Proverbs is addressed to children. You need to teach your boys and your girls the flip side of the joys of Proverbs 7, the beauties of a married relationship, and the evil destruction that we find in Proverbs 7, a polluted sexual relationship, before they hit puberty and they're driven to find out the difference for themselves. You need to give them the answers before the questions come. First, you need to show your children a positive vision of healthy sexuality. Tripp says this: it's important to let your children in on the fact that there is a sexual dimension to mom and dad's relationship. Some Christians have the mistaken idea that their children should never see mom and dad in any intimate embrace. The result is that the fraudulent affairs on TV and in the lives of wicked people are the only expressions of sexuality that they ever see. This is important. I am not talking about inviting children into the bedroom, and I would add, or talking about your sex life in some, exhibitionist sort of way, but about the importance of them knowing that there is a sexual dimension to mom and dad's relationship, and that you are attracted to your wife, and that your wife is attracted to you, and that sometimes you make them blush just a little bit. You know, we're not talking about revealing what shouldn't be revealed. They should just know that mom and dad have a relationship, that they're attracted to one another in a way that dad is not attracted to other women and mom is not attracted to other men. They should see that as something beautiful, so it's something that they desire. So when they learn a little bit later on about this thing called sexuality, they have a paradigm that makes them want to do it God's way. Second, you need to address with your children the distortions of sexuality as they encounter them. It's not cute for girls to act in a seductive way, no matter how young they are. It just isn't. So teach your daughters not just how to dress in a modest way, but how to walk and how to sit in a way that won't attract the attention of ungodly men when they get old enough to have something to attract them with. If you wait till your daughter is 16 to teach her not to act like she's, you know, trying to get men to come on to her, then it's really too late. You need to teach her that when she's 6. Teach boys to be respectful of girls, including their sisters. No handsy play, even between siblings. Teach them to keep their hands to themselves before they're motivated to not keep their hands to themselves. The point is that the control against sexual sin can't simply be external rules. Now, some of the things I mentioned are external rules, and we need to give them some rules, and we need to give them some boundaries, but we also need to be giving them. We're headed in this direction, not in that direction. Not just a bunch of arbitrary rules that have no context. Don't look at that. Don't touch that. Don't do this. Don't do that. And they're like, why? Oh, we'll tell you about it when you're older. No, even when they're younger, we need to be teaching them to live in a way that conforms to who God is and who they are. Now, we don't tell them everything all at once, right? There's really unhelpful ways this could be done. But drip by drip, day by day, we tell them the truth about the world. We warn them against the lies of the world so that they grow in understanding of the importance of moral purity. They have to see that biblical sexuality is more beautiful and more desirable than anything that the world has to offer. They have to see the difference between what is genuinely good and what is superficially attractive. And this is one of the things that I was getting at when I talked about excellence in taste. It's not just about having a taste for fine food. That's not actually the point. The point is being able to discern what is actually beautiful. And what is actually beautiful is a middle-aged couple who've gone through job losses and miscarriages and surgeries. And they may have gained a few pounds and added a few scars and gained a few wrinkles, but they love one another. And they've been faithful to one another decade after decade. What's beautiful is a couple in their 80s who can't get out of their wheelchairs anymore, but they still have stars in their eyes when they look at one another because they've had this relationship that's developed over the decades. That's what's beautiful. That's what sexuality is for. The best sexuality is not what's on the magazines. That's fake. And actually, it's ugly. It's not like, oh, this is so, like, you got to stay away from that because you'd never be able to resist the pull of that because it's just so amazing. But, you know, we have to obey God, and so we're going to, you know, do the boring stuff over here. No. We need to teach our children the way the world works, that the way of the devil leads to gravel in your mouth. It promises the moon, but it leads you into midnight darkness where you stumble and fall and receive ruin to yourself and bring ruin to others. So, when we're thinking of character issues, we need to, our goal is to teach them to live consistently with who God is and who they are. That's the character we're trying to develop. And therefore, we need to work at interpreting behavior in character terms. So when we see our children fighting over a toy, the answer isn't to give them a set of rules about how to deal with a toy. When we possibly can, we need to dig into the character that's being manifested by their attitude towards the toy. It may be that what they're manifesting is that the toy is more important to them than their sibling. Is that true? Is a flashlight more important than your brother or sister? Right, no, I'm asking you. Is the flashlight more important or the younger sister? Sister. But the fact is, they're living like the flashlight's more important. So the solution isn't just to give rules about the flashlight so you can get back to what you're doing, but to address the character issue that they are living a lie. And they need to live according to the truth. And that means that greed that doesn't generate conflict is just as dangerous as greed that does generate conflict. Just because it isn't making your life more difficult right now doesn't mean that you can ignore greed. In conclusion, we need to have a long-term vision. We can't just be concerned with what is making our lives more difficult right now. We need to think and constantly be envisioning what are those behaviors going to look like 10 years from now. So our 8-year-old is doing this with her friends. What will that look like when her friends are 18? Our 9-year-old is doing this with his stuff. What will that look like when he's 19? Those are the questions we need to be asking. Our goal during this season, so we talked about infancy, that first stage, and in that first stage, we need to teach them the principle of authority. In the second stage, the focus really shifts to instilling character. We're still working on authority. It's not like our children turn 5, and they know everything there is to know about authority because we've done a perfect job teaching them. No, we've still got to keep pouring some cement into the foundation. Absolutely. But we also need to begin building on that foundation so that there's some rebar and studs, however the house is being built, so that as they grow into their teen years, there's some structure in their lives and they can begin to develop, to flourish, and to prepare to launch. Father, I come before you and I thank you for the children you've given us and for the church you've given us to raise them in. Thank you for your word. Help us to be faithful.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading it for yourself.